Hi, this is Fannie
Love
Brewster.
Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Fannie Brewster, once again with you, with C.G. Young in his own words. Today, I'm doing a reading from The Spirit in Man, Art, and Literature from Volume 15. And the title of the work is On the Relation of Analytical Psychology to Poetry. This will be a reading in three parts. So today is only the first section of this essay by Jung. And then for the next two episodes, I'll be continuing with readings from this selection. On the Relation of Analytical Psychology to Poetry. In spite of its difficulty, the task of discussing the relation of analytical psychology to poetry affords me a welcome opportunity to define my views on the much-debated question of the relations between psychology and art in general. Although the two things cannot be compared, the close connection which undoubtedly exists between them calls for investigation. These connections arise from the fact that the practice of art is a psychological activity and as such can be approached from a psychological angle. Considered in this light, like any other human activity deriving from psychic motives, is a proper subject for psychology. This statement, however, involves a very definite limitation of the psychological viewpoint when we come to apply it in practice. Only that aspect of art which consists in the process of artistic creation can be a subject for psychological study, but not that which constitutes its essential nature. The question of what art is in itself can never be answered by the psychologist, but must be approached from the side of aesthetics. A similar distinction must be made in the realm of religion. A psychological approach is permissible only in regard to the emotions and symbols which constitute the phenomenology of religion, but which do not touch upon its essential nature. If the essence of religion and art could be explained, then both of them would become mere subdivisions of psychology. This is not to say that such violations of their nature have not been attempted, but those who are guilty of them obviously forget that a similar fate might easily befall psychology, since its intrinsic value and specific quality would be destroyed if it were regarded as a mere activity of the brain and were relegated along with the endocrine functions to a subdivision of physiology. This too, as we know, has been attempted. Art by its very nature is not science, and science by its very nature is not art. Both these spheres of the mind have something in reserve that is peculiar to them and can be explained only in its own terms. Hence, when we speak of the relation of psychology to art, we shall treat only of that aspect of art which can be submitted to psychological scrutiny without violating its nature. Whatever the psychologist has to say about art will be confined to the process of artistic creation and has nothing to do with its innermost essence. He can no more explain this than the intellect can describe or even understand the nature of feeling. Indeed, art and science would not exist as separate entities at all if the fundamental difference between them had not long since forced itself on the mind. The fact that artistic, scientific, and religious propensities still slumber peacefully together in the small child, the beginnings of art, science, and religion coalesce in the undifferentiated chaos of the magical mentality, or that no trace of mind can be found in the natural instinct of animals, all this does nothing to prove the existence of a unifying principle which alone would justify a reduction of one to the other. For if we go so far back into the history of the mind that the distinctions between its various fields of activity become altogether invisible, we do not reach an underlying principle of their unity, but merely an earlier undifferentiated state in which no separate activities can exist. But the elementary state is not an explanatory principle that would allow us to draw conclusions as to the nature of later, more highly developed states, even though they must necessarily derive from it. A scientific attitude will always tend to overlook the peculiar nature of these more differentiated states in favor of their causal derivation and will endeavor to subordinate them to general but more elementary principle. These theoretical reflections seem to me very much in place today, when we so often find that works of art, and particularly poetry, are interpreted precisely in this manner by reducing them to more elementary states. Though the material he works with and its individual treatment can easily be traced back to the poet's personal relations with his parents, this does not enable us to understand his poetry. The same reduction can be made in all sorts of other fields, and not least in the case of pathological disturbances. Neuroses and psychoses are likewise reducible to infantile relations with the parent. And so are a man's good and bad habits, his beliefs, peculiarities, passions, interests, and so forth. It can hardly be supposed that all these very different things must have exactly the same explanation, for otherwise we would be driven to the conclusion that they actually are the same thing. If a work of art is explained in the same way as neuroses, then either the work of art is a neuroses or a neuroses is a work of art. This explanation is all very well as a play on words, but sound common sense rebels against putting a work of art on the same level as a neurosis. An analyst might, in an extreme case, view a neurosis as a work of art through the lens of his professional bias, but it would never occur to an intelligent layman to mistake a pathological phenomenon for art, in spite of the undeniable fact that a work of art arises from much the same psychological conditions as a neurosis. This is only natural because certain of these conditions are present in every individual and owing to the relative constancy of the human environment are constantly the same, whether in the case of a nervous intellectual, a poet, or a normal human being. All have had parents, all have a father or mother complex, all know about sex, and therefore have certain common and typical human difficulties. One poet may be influenced more by his relation to his father, another by the tie to his mother, while a third shows unmistakable traces of sexual repression in his poetry. Since all this can be said equally well, not only of every neurotic, but of every normal human being, nothing specific is gained for the judgment of a work of art. At most, our knowledge of its psychological antecedents will have been broadened and deepened. The school of medical psychology inaugurated by Freud has undoubtedly encouraged the literary historian to bring certain peculiarities of a work of art into relation with the intimate personal life of the poet. But this is nothing new in principle, for it has long been known that the scientific treatment of art will reveal the personal threads that the artist intentionally or unintentionally has woven into the work. The Freudian approach may, however, make possible a more exhaustive demonstration of the influences that reach back into earliest childhood and play their part in artistic creation. To this extent, the psychoanalysis of art differs in no essential from the subtle psychological nuances of a penetrating literary analysis. The difference is, at most a question of degree, though we may occasionally be surprised by indiscreet references to things which a rather more delicate touch might have passed over, if only for reasons of tact. This lack of delicacy seems to be a professional peculiarity of the medical psychologist, and the temptation to draw daring conclusions easily leads to flagrant abuses. A slight whiff of scandal often leads spice to a biography, but a little more becomes a nasty inquisitiveness, bad taste, masquerading as science. Our interest is insidiously deflected from the work of art and gets lost in the labyrinth of psychic determinants. The poet becomes a clinical case, and very likely yet another addition to the curious of sexual psychopathology. But this means that the psychoanalysis of art has turned aside from its proper objective and strayed into a province that is as broad as mankind, that is not in the least specific of the artist, and has even less relevance to his art. This kind of analysis brings the work of art into the sphere of general human psychology, where many other things besides art have their origin. To explain art in these terms is just as great a platitude as the statement that every artist is a narcissist. Every man who pursues his own goal is a narcissist, though one wonders how permissible it is to give such wide currency to a term specifically coined for the pathology of neuroses. The statement therefore amounts to nothing. It merely elicits the faint surprise of a bon mot. Since this type of analysis is in no way concerned with the work of art itself, but strives like a mole to bury itself in the dirt as speedily as possible, it always ends up in the common earth that unites all mankind. Hence, its explanations have the same tedious monotony as the recitals which one daily hears in the consulting room. The reductive method of Freud is a purely medical one, and the treatment is directed at a pathological or otherwise unsuitable formation which has taken the place of the normal functioning. It must therefore be broken down and the way cleared for healthy adaptation. In this case, reduction to the common human foundation is altogether appropriate, but when applied to a work of art, it leads to the results I have described. It strips the work of art of its shimmering robes and exposes the nakedness and drabness of Homo sapiens, to which species the poet and artist also belong. The golden gleam of artistic creation, the original object of discussion, is extinguished as soon as we apply to it the same corrosive method which we use in analyzing the fantasies of hysteria. The results are no doubt very interesting and may perhaps have the same kind of scientific value as Nietzsche, for instance, which might conceivably show us the particular atypical form of paralysis from which he died. But what would this have to do with Zarathustra? Whatever its subterranean background may have been, is it not a whole world in itself, beyond the human, all too human imperfections? I have spoken of Freud's reductive method, but have not stated in what the method consists. It is essentially a medical technique for investigating morbid psychic phenomena, and it is solely concerned with the ways and means of getting round or peering through the foreground of consciousness in order to reach the psychic background or the unconscious. It is based on the assumption that the neurotic patient represses certain psychic contents because they are normally incompatible with his conscious values. It follows that the repressed contents must have correspondingly negative traits, infantile, sexual, obscene, or even criminal, which make them unacceptable to consciousness. So since no man is perfect, everyone must possess such a background, whether he admits it or not. Hence, it can always be exposed if only one uses the technique of interpretation worked out by Freud. In the short space of a lecture, I cannot, of course, enter into the details of the technique. A few hints must suffice. The unconscious background does not remain inactive, but betrays itself by its characteristic effects on the contents of consciousness. For example, it produces fantasies of a peculiar nature, which can easily be interpreted as sexual images, or it produces characteristic disturbances of the conscious processes, which again can be reduced to repressed contents. A very important source for knowledge of the unconscious contents is provided by dreams, since these are direct products of the activity of the unconscious. The essential thing in Freud's reductive method is to collect all the clues pointing to the unconscious background, and then, through the analysis and interpretation of this material, to construct the elementary instinctual processes. These conscious contents, which give us a clue to the unconscious background, are incorrectly called symbols by Freud. They are not true symbols, however, since according to his theory, they have merely the role of signs or symptoms of the subliminal processes. The true symbol differs essentially from this and should be understood as an expression of an intuitive idea that cannot yet be formulated in any other or better way. When Plato, for instance, puts the whole problem of the theory of knowledge in his parable of the cave, or when Christ expresses the idea of the kingdom of heaven in parables, these are genuine and true symbols, that is, attempts to express something for which no verbal concept yet exists. If we were to interpret Plato's metaphor in Freudian terms, we would naturally arrive at the uterus and would have proved that even a mind like Plato's was still stuck on a level of infantile sexuality. But we would have completely overlooked what Plato actually created out of the primal determinants of his philosophical ideas. We would have missed the essential point and merely discovered that he had infantile sexual fantasies like any other mortal. Such a discovery could be of value only for a man who regarded Plato as superhuman and who can now state with satisfaction that Plato too was an ordinary human being. But who would want to regard Plato as a god? Surely only one who is dominated by infantile fantasies and therefore possesses an erotic mentality. For him, the reduction to common human truths is salutary on medical grounds, but this would have nothing whatever to do with the meaning of Plato's parable. I have purposely dwelt on the application of medical psychoanalysis to works of art because I want to emphasize that the psychoanalytic method is at the same time an essential part of the Freudian doctrine. Freud himself, by his rigid dogmatism, has ensured that the method and the doctrine, in themselves two very different things, are regarded by the public as identical. Yet the method may be employed without beneficial benefits or results in medical cases, without at the same time exalting it into a doctrine. And against this doctrine, we are bound to raise vigorous objections. The assumptions it rests on are quite arbitrary. For example, neuroses are by no means exclusively caused by sexual repression, and the same holds true for psychosis. There is no foundation for saying that dreams merely contain repressed wishes, whose moral incompatibility requires them to be disguised by a hypothetical dream censor. The Freudian technique of interpretation, so far as it remains under the influence of its own one-sided and therefore erroneous hypotheses, displays a quite obvious bias. In order to do justice to a work of art, analytical psychology must rid itself entirely of medical prejudice. For a work of art is not a disease, and consequently requires a different approach from the medical one. A doctor naturally has to seek out the causes of a disease in order to pull it up by the roots, but just as naturally, the psychologist must adopt exactly the opposite attitude towards a work of art. Instead of investigating its typically human determinants, he will inquire first of all into its meaning and will concern himself with its determinants only insofar as they enable him to understand it more fully. Personal causes have as much or as little to do with a work of art as the soil with the plant that springs from it. We can certainly learn to understand some of the plant's peculiarities by getting to know its habitat. And for the botanist, this is an important part of his equipment. But nobody will maintain that everything essential has then been discovered about the plant itself. The personal orientation which the doctor needs when confronted with the question of ideology in medicine is quite out of place in dealing with a work of art, just because a work of art is not a human being, but is something supra-personal. It is a thing and not a personality. Hence, it cannot be judged by personal criteria. Indeed, the special circumstance and significance of a true work of art resides in the fact that it has escaped from the limitations of the personal and has soared beyond the personal concerns of its creator. And so that concludes the first reading of this selection from The Spirit in Man, Art, and Literature on the relation of analytical psychology and poetry. I look forward to meeting with you again next week. Until then, goodbye.